In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s?
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Hey there, welcome once again to another episode of Strange Planet. And if you'd like to get deeper into Strange Planet, you might want to consider becoming a premium subscriber. It's real easy to do. Just click on the link in the episode notes, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. You gain access to commercial-free listening, bonus episodes, a subscription to my newsletter, Inner Sanctum, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. There are three tiers to choose from. Choose the one that's right for you. StrangePlanet.supportingcast.fm. We are quickly approaching the 60th anniversary of the murder of the 35th President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and a brand new book, The JFK Assassination, Chokeholds That Prove There Was a Conspiracy. There are several contributors to the book, and we'll tell you about each of those a little bit later. One of the contributors, however, is no stranger to this program. He's been with me many, many times. James DiEugenio has an MA in history from California State University, Northridge. He's a retired teacher who's written, co-edited four books on the assassination of the 60s, Destiny Betrayed, The Assassinations, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and JFK Revisited. The last volume is the companion piece to Oliver Stone's two recent documentaries on the Kennedy assassination, JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass and JFK Destiny Betrayed. Jim wrote the screenplays for both of those films. He's lectured widely and made many appearances on many broadcast programs about the subject. He's the editor and publisher of the online journal KennedysandKing.com, which I highly recommend you check out, KennedysandKing.com, which features articles, news stories, and critiques of works about the four major assassinations of the 60s, JFK, Malcolm X, MLK, and RFK. Jim DiGiugno, welcome back. How are you?
It's nice to be back. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
The JFK assassination chokeholds that prove there was a conspiracy. All right, so tell us about the other contributors to this book, Paul Blue.
Paul Blue from Paul Blue. Quebec. Matt Crumpton, who lives in Ohio. We have also Adam Eiler, who lives in Ontario, I think in Hamilton. And Mark Adamchik, who is in Naples, Florida. Now, the last three guys I named are all attorneys. All right. And Eiler and Adamchik have done a lot of really good work on the JFK Act. So that's how they figure into this book. Paul does a lot of articles for KennedysandKing.com. I'd say at least 10 or 12. And he appeared in JFK Revisited, which I'm sure you saw.
Yes.
Okay. He was a guy talking about the prior plots to kill Kennedy, namely in Tampa and then in Chicago, okay, which is probably the most famous plot, okay, the plot to kill Kennedy in Chicago. He was very good on both those, and Oliver enjoyed talking to him. So those are, Matt has a podcast called Solving JFK, which is very good, by the way. A lot of animation, a lot of films, etc. So it's really a distinguished cast.
Yes.
You know, exactly. if I say so myself.
And you may. Right. And you've all contributed chapters in the book. Now, the origin story of how you all came together, how this book came together, you've actually sort of printed it in the book. It's, you know, including the dialogue that took place. You met, I believe, was it all at a Citizens Against Political Assassinations conference?
Yes, you're exactly right. In the beginning of the book, it's described how this idea came together, and it's owed to the very distinguished British researcher on JFK, Malcolm Blunt. Okay, see, Malcolm doesn't get a lot of credit because he's more of a workhorse than a show horse. He's the guy who goes into the archive and finds all this stuff. And so what Paul was talking about with Malcolm is something that I'd written about before, but is in the book. And this is called the filing system of Oswald's file. And Malcolm said, if you examine how Oswald's file began and the work done on it by House Select Committee analyst Betsy Wolf, I believe that that's a chokehold. I believe that's something the CIA cannot explain at all, period. Do you want me to sum that up in a minute?
Yeah, but first, because that's the title of the book, Chokeholds. What is meant by chokehold?
It's, well, what Malcolm meant, and I think the way Paul adapted it, was that there's really no other explanation except the official story is wrong. Okay, you there's no really way, there's no strong way to weasel out of these particular points that we're bringing up. And if this was a court of law, okay, the so-called official story would not be able to survive. And I think Paul makes the point that any one of these would be very strong points to exonerate Oswald. The combination of them all would be overwhelming. It'd be like, you know, I think the British have a term called no case to answer. You know, when they throw out a case, that's what they call it. Hmm. And so that's what we were trying to do.
Right, right. And at the very, very least, in a court of law, you would raise such reasonable doubt as to have exonerated Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes, I don't think there's any question. And that's why we actually wanted the three lawyers in there. Okay, in the book, there's a very neat section, which I had never seen before, in which Mr. Eiler goes ahead and explains what standards of proof are. Yes. And he talks about how the reasonable doubt standard originated. And I had never seen this particular thing before. He says if you trace it back to the beginning of British colonial law, okay, what that standard of proof was meant to do, it was to prevent the collective guilt of a community for condemning an innocent man to death. Now, I can't think of a better case than Oswald as the collective guilt of a community for condemning a man, okay, without even giving him. And this is what's so extraordinary, without even giving them the benefit of a trial.
Right, right. Before you get to the Oswald filing system, there's one more term I think I'd like you to define, and that is it's the notion of proof called the concept of consilience.
Yes. What Paul was trying to talk about there was the fact that these things interrelate to each other. And once they're combined, okay, then it's a fact that they all unify in a way to make a very powerful case, all right, is something that attorneys look for, you know, in a court of law. For example, on the forensic side, there's the lack of chain of custody on CE-399 combined with the proof of a frontal shot, okay? You know, and those two things link together, okay, to show that not only was CE-399 that would never be admitted into a court of law.
That's the magic bullet that was found on supposedly right. Connolly's gurney that went through, caused seven injuries before coming out in pristine condition being found on a hospital gurney.
And there's a very open question on which gurney it was found on, mm-hmm. okay, which yeah. I'm sure you're familiar with. All right.
Thanks
okay. And the combination of that with the proof of the frontal shot, which we devoted chapter to, plus my chapter on the question of was this really Kennedy's brain? See, very, very few. I don't know if I talked to you about this before, but one of the great bombshells of the review board, the Assassinations Record Review Board, is that they cross-examined the guy who's supposed to be the official photographer of Kennedy's autopsy. Mm-hmm. A guy named John Stringer. And they confronted him with the pictures he was supposed to have taken of Kennedy's brain. And they had him right there. Jeremy Gunn and Doug Horn, who worked for the ARB, had them right in front of him. And he said, and he walked up to them. And he looked at them very closely. And he said, I didn't use this kind of film.
Yeah, those aren't my pictures.
And I didn't use that kind of press pack technique. He said, see these numbers here on the bottom? See, this means it was taken as part of a press pack because they're in serial. Goes, I didn't use that technique. And then they asked him, I see, are you ready to say that you didn't take those pictures? And he said, if that's Ansco film, by the way, which it was, and if that's a press pack, which it was, then I didn't take these pictures. Okay. And so these are the things we tried to put in there. You know, I mean, first of all, of course, anybody familiar with the legal system would know that that's evidence of fraud. Mm-hmm. You have to have the guy who took the pictures. He has to admit under oath that he took the pictures. Okay. And then when you have with CE-399 or the magic bullet, when you have the guy, Bardwell Odom, the FBI agent, who's recorded in the memo as saying, I took this around to the original people who found the magic bullet, that is Tomlinson and Wright. And they both verified that this was the bullet they found. Well, when Gary Aguilar and Tink Thompson got in contact with Bardwell Odom and they read him this, he said, I never did any such thing. I never showed that bullet to anybody. And I would know for certain if I did it to O.P. Wright, because I knew O.P. Wright. Okay, he was the director of security at Parkland. So these are the kind of, see, that's another case of fraud. See, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you this. If you can prove fraud in the courtroom, you can move to have the whole case thrown out.
Right, right. Everything okay. is tainted at that point. Everything becomes tainted.
Right, right.
What about the sketches of the supposed exit wound? That's another case, isn't it?
Okay, well, this is another thing that the ARB, the review board, should I explain what that is?
Yes, yeah, the assassination review board.
After JFK came out in 1991, Oliver Stone's feature film, this created a firestorm, all right, because at the end he said the files of the House Select Committee are still classified. And so they put together this citizens board called the Assassinations Record Review Board. And that was their job, to declassify the rest of the documents. And they were allowed to investigate, okay, certain issues. And one of the things they decided to investigate was Kennedy's autopsy. What you're talking about is that in the files of the House Select Committee, which was the last investigation, they did not declassify the drawings and the affidavits of the people at both Parkland Hospital and Bethesda, where the autopsy was supposed to be held, okay, that night, which revealed this baseball-sized exit wound in the back of Kennedy's head. Now, once these were all tallied together, there was approximately 42 witnesses who testified to the House Select Committee combination, okay, that this is what they saw. Now, what makes this even worse is that in the actual House Select Committee report, there isn't any way to sugarcoat this. They lied about this. They said that contrary to the witnesses at Parkland Hospital, the witnesses at Bethesda Medical Center did not see this exit wound in the back of Kennedy's head. Well, you can say that if you don't declassify the documents that prove that it's a false statement. Okay, but once it was declassified, that was exposed as a lie. I mean, there's no other way to say it. Okay, and nobody, by the way, nobody wanted to take responsibility for it either. Okay, nobody on the House Select Committee wanted to admit that they wrote it. Okay.
Would that be another chokehold?
Well, in my opinion, yes. How can 42 people be wrong?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can 42 people be wrong? And so, and of course, this would bring into question those pictures which do not depict such an exit hole. All right.
Yes. Yes. How does Vincent Bugliosi in Reclaiming History, does he approach any of these chokeholds? Does he try to?
Well, no. For example, for the one about Oswald's file, that one is not even mentioned. Okay.
Oh, we need to come back to Oswald's file because I forgot. I need you to expand on that. But
that one doesn't even come up. All right. The one about the autopsy, this is something that Bugliosi essentially dances around. Okay. And he tries to say that the photographs would take precedence over the people's memories, which, in my opinion, I don't think that would have happened in the court of law. All right. And then he, in talking about the issue of JFK's brain, which was another chapter that I wrote in the book. All right. I wrote about JFK's brain and the magic bullet. All right. He tries to smear the whole report that Douglas Horn made on that. And he tries, and he uses the cheapest tricks I've ever seen in order to smear that whole realm of investigation into only, you know, some kind of lunatic would even believe, you know, that such would be the case. And that's the way he dodges the fact that the illustrations and pictures of Kennedy's brain cannot represent Kennedy's brain. Okay. I mean, and this is simply, I believe, beyond a shadow of a doubt today, that this is the case. that somebody took some phony pictures and tried to substitute them, or they took another brain out of that hospital and tried to substitute it as Kennedy's brain. You want to talk about those two issues, the file and...
Yeah, let's do the file, and then we'll take a timeout, but let's talk about the Oswald filing system.
Okay, very quickly. Betsy Wolf was the investigator for the House Select Committee on the Oswald file. She got every single charter in the CIA, I think there's 9 of them, and she read through every single one. And then she did an imaginary graft showing, well, this is how Oswald's file should have gone through the agency. Then she asked for the file. And as she read the file, she realized, wait a minute, this is not what should have happened. It should not have gone to this place where it did go. It should have gone to the Soviet Russia division, not the very secret counterintelligence department where it went to. All right. So then what she decided to do, I'm going to have to talk to people to find out why this happened. Because in addition to going to the wrong place, the other problem was that nobody knew about this. Okay. Nobody knew about this or where the heck it was going. There was no explanation given. Okay. Because nobody else in the CIA knew about it. So this really interested her. All right. And so she started interviewing people. Finally, in I believe September of 1978, she interviewed a guy named Richard Gambino, who was the head of the security department at that time, which is where the file went. All right. Office of Security. Explaining her problem, Gambino said, look, it doesn't matter how many documents you get. It doesn't matter if they're pre-stamped. If the client goes to the Office of Mail Logistics, which is the first gate into the CIA, and says, I want those files sent here and only here, that is what will happen. So this was really a bombshell. Because what it seems to indicate is that somebody was rigging Oswald's file secretly while he was on his way to Russia. This is why there was no what they call a 201 file opened, which is the most common file in the CIA and which everybody has access to. Not only did they rig the file, they didn't want anybody to know they were rigging the file. Now, why would you do that? we can only ponder this. And by the way, that didn't make it into the House Select Committee report.
We'll take a time out. The JFK assassination chokeholds that prove there was a conspiracy. James D. Eugenio stays with us.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Everytown Podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and take into his underground bunker in the woods. And we give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Everytown Podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
The truth will set you free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
We're back with James DiEugenio. The JFK assassination chokeholds that prove there was a conspiracy. He's one of the contributors, along with Paul Blue, Matt Crumpton, Andrew Eiler, and Mark Adamczyk, three of whom are lawyers, attorneys, and laying out the case. These are indisputable facts that prove there was a conspiracy. If this was a court of law, it would exonerate Lee Harvey Oswald. And here we are 60 years later after the assassination. Do you feel like finally the veil is lifting, or the official narrative is kind of crumbling as the mainstream media becomes increasingly irrelevant? You know, thanks to people like Joe Rogan or Elon Musk or now Tucker Carlson, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. making the rounds and talking about, yes, how the CIA was responsible for his uncle's murder. Tucker Carlson just, you know, sang all the quiet parts out loud before, you know, millions and millions of people on social media. How do you feel now about the state of JFK or about the truth regarding his assassination?
Well, you know, I have to agree with you. There does seem to be some initial crumbling of the official story in the mainstream media. A lot of this is due to Paul Landis, the Secret Service agent, who now says that he found an extra bullet, okay, which he's found in the back of the car, and he placed it on Kennedy's gurney. That story initially ran in Vanity Fair. Then, if you can believe it, it actually ran in the New York Times. And this created a kind of hubbub because now, from what I understand, my friend David Talbot, the founder of Salon Magazine, he's been asked by the New York Times to bring in some of the new developments in the JFK. You know, it's almost like they've been asleep for 59 mm-hmm. years.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden this Landis guy comes up. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe we were wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, and so yes, I agree with you that there is some movement now in this case. And by the way, and we should also you mentioned some people who are important, and they are important, but we should also mention Oliver Stone and Jefferson Morley, okay, because they were also important, I believe. And by the way, I have to tell you, I just got this news from our producer Rob Wilson. Mm-hmm. JFK Revisited is still selling. It just sold in Japan, Hong Kong, and Macau in the last month. It was featured at the Tokyo Film Festival. Okay, it's the long version is being shown on TV. The short version is being shown in theaters as we speak.
That's amazing. JFK Revisited through the Looking Glass.
Right.
And let's go back to the brain.
Oh, okay. I wrote this chapter in the book. All right. And I became convinced of this because, number one, Stringer, which we already talked about, denying the photographs. Okay, that's number one. Number two, the official weight of Kennedy's brain, which is penciled in at 1,500 grams. Which is 160 grams more than the average weight of a person's brain. Hmm. Okay. How on earth could Kennedy's brain weigh that much more than an average brain, especially with all the photographic evidence we have? I mean, I don't have to tell you about this, but at Z313, in the Zapruder film, mm-hmm. that's the famous frame of the head explosion.
Yeah.
Okay. And we see that head explosion right in the film.
In other words, there's not much left of his brain. How can it weigh?
Right, exactly. And then you take a look at the pictures of the back seat. Mm-hmm. That can only come from Kennedy's brain because Jackie wasn't hit. Okay. And then you have Jackie going out on the back of the car to get a piece of Kennedy's brain, which, by the way, she gave to a doctor, you know, at Parkland Hospital. Then the coup de grace is all the witnesses at both Parkland and Bethesda who said that they saw a severely damaged brain, some of them saying that one third of it was missing. So how in God's green earth can Kennedy's brain weigh above the average when so many people attest to so much of it being missing? This, I believe, I really believe this today. This is the whole Rosetta Stone to the JFK case. They went to these kind of extremes not to show the fact that Kennedy was hit by multiple bullets in the skull.
So they switched switched brains?
Yes, I believe that, and by the way, that I'm not alone in that. We had Michael Chesser, who's a neurologist. We had Gary Aguilar, who's another doctor. Okay, we had David Mantic talking about it, who's a radiologist. You know, they've studied it more than I have, and they've come to this that is not Kennedy's brain. That these are this is the kind of subterfuge that went on at that hospital. All right. And by the way, I should add, I don't have to tell you this. What the heck were all those military people doing at Kennedy's autopsy?
Mm-hmm.
There were over 40 people there. All right. What on earth were they all doing? Why was Curtis LeMay flying in from Canada to Washington that night? Why did he lie about where he was flying in from? Why wouldn't he answer his aide de camp, Colonel Dudman, who kept on asking him, General, where do you plan on flying into? Okay, why did he break orders and not come into Andrews Airfield? Instead, he went to National. Because he knew there would be tons of media there that night when his plane was coming in. So these are all questions that, unfortunately, 59, 60 years later, we're still asking.
Mm.
Okay. And thank God for people like you, you know, who actually do pose these questions and the public gets to hear them.
I'm going to save this for after the break. We've got another break coming, and then I want to get into another chokehold, and that is Oswald could not have been on the sixth floor when the shots were fired. He could not be placed on the sixth floor when the fatal shots were fired. We'll get to that with James DiEugenio as we continue to discuss the JFK assassination, the 60th anniversary, chokeholds that prove there was a conspiracy.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
James DiEugenio, the JFK assassination chokeholds that prove there was a conspiracy. This is some pretty basic stuff. I mean, if you can't place the accused at the scene of the crime, in this case, the sixth floor of the Texas Book Depository building, you've got a major problem. Okay, so unpack that for us a little bit, if you could, Jim.
All right. You're exactly correct. If you can't place the suspect where he's supposed to be when he commits the crime, then the guy has an alibi. You can't be in two places at one time, all right? So Matt Crumpton wrote the chapter in the Chokeholds book about this. Very, very strong evidence that Oswald was not there, all right? For instance, Carolyn Arnold, who was a secretary, said she Oswald on the lower floors at about 12:25. Okay. She claimed that her testimony was altered because in the official document it said 12:15 when Earl Goltz, a reporter, tracked her down and showed her this. She goes, "That's not what I said." Okay, it was more like 12:20 or 12:25 when I saw Oswald down there. All right. Now, there's also the fact that the secretaries on the fourth floor who were watching the motorcade and then went downstairs never saw Oswald, okay, or heard him, which I think is even more compelling. Okay, they said that they were watching the motorcade when the car went under the trestle. They turned around and walked out of their office, okay, out the from the window to the office door, and then went down the stairs. Okay, they never saw nor heard Oswald. Now, what makes this even more convincing is their supervisor, Dorothy Garner, was interviewed by Martha Jo Stroud, who was the local attorney from the Attorney General's office, the Federal Attorney General's office in Dallas. She backed this story up. She said she saw Sandy and Victoria going down the stairs, and she waited there until the supervisor, the foreman of the place, Roy Truly, and the policeman, Marion Baker, came up the stairs. Never saw Oswald that whole time. Now, let me explain what I mean about not hearing him. See, before they closed that area off at the sixth floor museum, I was there in, I believe, 1991. Okay, and you could go up and down those stairs at that time. In fact, I even looked out the window. They even allowed you to do that. All right. Those stairs are the old-fashioned, like out of the 1920s kind of stairs. Those are not the modern stairs you get in office buildings that are kind of short. Sometimes they're cushioned with cloth or something.
Right.
All right. Those are the kind of rickety hammer and nail stairs, okay, from the olden days. So what I'm saying is it's hard enough to believe they wouldn't have seen him. It's almost impossible to believe they wouldn't have heard him come down those stairs. Now, if you put those kind of witnesses on the stand, you know, Arnold, the two secretaries and their supervisor, then I think you have a very strong case for Oswald not being on the sixth floor.
Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig, former Dallas County Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig, was also on the scene after hearing the shots fired. Did he say that he saw Oswald climb into a green Rambler?
Yes.
Shortly after.
That's correct. Okay. He said he saw Oswald coming down the incline across the street from the Texas School Book Depository, and then he saw him jump in the car of a Nash Rambler, all right, with what he said was a dark-complected man driving the car. Now, he was not alone in this. There was another witness, Marvin Robinson, who attested to more or less the same thing, okay? And Roger Craig stood by that story until the end of his life, okay? Now, and he suffered a lot, he got thrown off to Dallas police because he was talking to too many people, okay? You know, and the Warren Commission, of course, had to reject this because this would indicate strongly that there was a second Oswald, okay? And there was a second Oswald right there in the middle of Dealey Plaza. And also it would explain that how Oswald got to the Texas Theater so fast, and it would probably eliminate him from the whole Tippit shooting. Okay, so that was the officer who was killed at 10th and yes. Peyton at around 108, 109 that afternoon. All right. So yes, that's a very, very important aspect to this case, and, you know, indicating that Oswald was not on the sixth floor at that time. I believe that that's a chokehold.
You mentioned the impersonations. How many Oswald impersonators do we know of?
Oh my God. Okay. First of all, there's the people who were supposed to be at the target shooting places. Okay. Those were people who testified that they saw somebody who either resembled Oswald or called himself Oswald and was at a shooting range. These were mostly in the Dallas area prior to the assassination. These were really credible witnesses, if you ask me. And they stood by their stories. But the commission tried to explain this away by saying that, no, Oswald couldn't have been there because he was somewhere else. He was either with his wife or at Ruth Payne's house, his landlord at the time, etc. Okay, and so they tried to explain these incidents of target shooting away because they didn't want to admit that somebody might have been impersonating Oswald. There's also the car lot. Okay. A guy named Oswald went into, I think, a Mercury dealer, all right, in that area, Dallas-Fort Worth area, and said, I'm looking for a car because I'm going to come into a lot of money.
Just so you remember I was here. Yeah.
Remember me on November 22nd, okay? Yes. And so then he drove this car around like 70 miles an hour to make himself even more memorable, okay? And then he declined to buy the car. All right, so in other words, you have a guy target shooting. You have a guy saying that I'm going to come into a lot of money and I want to buy this new, brand new car. I mean, really? I mean, how obvious can you get? You know, but the commission would not believe these stories. Well, they couldn't believe them. All right. But there's just too many of them to deny that it was a recurring pattern. You know, because of course, if you admit them, then you have to say there was a plan. There's also the Sylvia Odio incident. All right. This was in late September of 1963 when Sylvia Odio, who is a Cuban exile, had three men come to her door and they asked about getting money for the secret war against Cuba. And one of them was referred to as Oswald. All right. One of the Cubans, the two Cuban guys who was accompanied Oswald, called Sylvia back the next day. And he said, you know, this Oswald guy's kind of loco. He thinks we should have killed Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs. Now, you start grouping these things together. You know, I don't see how more obvious you can get. Now, the commission rejected Sylvia Odio. And get the reason they rejected her. Because Oswald was supposed to be in Mexico City at the time.
Mm.
Now, I'm glad I'm on a chair because I'd be on the floor laughing, you know, if I wasn't. Because you can get into Mexico City and the impersonations down there, you know, are enough to blow your head away. Okay? You know, so, yes, I believe.
Key to their whole case. That's the key to the Warren Commission.
Yes,
Oswald was in Mexico going to the Soviet embassy, right?
Both of them, the Soviet and the Cuban embassies.
Yeah.
You know, except they can't produce a picture. And the voice, the taped of the voice don't match. A little bit of a problem there. Okay, so these impersonations are all, I believe, relevant. Okay, and if you combine them with the prior attempts to kill Kennedy, you know, like I've always said, Kennedy was not getting out of 1963 alive.
No. Prior attempts, one would be Chicago. Was right. It in Miami?
Oh, there was one in Miami. The one we dealt with was in Tampa.
Ah.
Okay. Because in those two cases, the alleged patsy resembles Oswald. Okay, Valet and Gilberto Lopez, Valet in Chicago, Gilberto Lopez in Tampa. Gilberto Lopez was a member of the FPCC, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. All right. And when he got out of Tampa, which I believe was on the day of the assassination, he went through the Dallas-Fort Worth area and then went to Mexico City, I believe, and then got a plane headed to Havana. You know, that's pretty extraordinary, is it not? You would think that they would investigate this. You know, isn't this kind of odd? Fair Play for Cuba Committee goes into Texas, then he goes to Mexico City, then he flies on a plane to Havana, you know? So those are the kind of things that were ignored by the Warren Commission.
The remaining documents that have not been released, excuse me, they're released by the, according to the Records Act, which is, they're in violation of the law here, right? Federal law. They are to.
Oh, I don't know there's any question about it. And yeah. By the way, it's even worse than that, because it appears that Biden has now, well, more than appears, Biden changed the law. Okay. He now set up this special committee that's going to oversee the last of, I believe, 4,000 pages of documents that have still not been released. Those should have been declassified, I'm sure you know this, in 2017, because mm-hmm. that was the termination date. Here we are in 2023 at the 60th anniversary, and we still can't see all the documents. And believe me, it's not just me, it's also Andrew and Mark, okay, who are specialists on this. They believe that we're not going to see them. You know, the CIA made up this new plan that Biden adapted of this special board, which FBI and CIA can make pleas to not to declassify the last of the documents.
In other words, anybody that was involved at this point, individuals, probably dead. So what they're protecting now, not the names of individuals, but they're protecting the institutions, the CIA.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. They're covering their behinds. They don't want to say the CIA was involved, and they don't want to see the FBI as part of a cover-up, which I believe the evidence is pretty overwhelming about the FBI covering it up. You know, we still need a little bit more information from the CIA, but they're not going to give it to us.
JFK assassination chokeholds that prove there was a conspiracy. There are 10 chokeholds. We just kind of skimmed through a few of them. We don't want to give it all away, but how do we get the book, Jim?
You can right now. It's available on Amazon. Okay, it's going to be officially released on the 14th. Okay, right now it's available on Amazon. You can go ahead and order it in Barnes and Noble and several other places. I'm going to be in Cincinnati at the Mercantile Library on the evening of the 14th at 6 p.m. There's a nominal fee, like about $10. And I'll be doing a lecture there. So just look it up. And if you want to come down, I have some autographed books of JFK Revisited. You might be able to actually bring chokeholds at that time. I'll be glad to autograph that also. Fantastic. It's going to be released in paperback and the ebook version.
All right. And then you and I are going to go even for a deeper dive on Coast to Coast on the 18th. Congratulations to you and all of the contributors. Thank you for this.
Thank you, sir.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.